Hello, everyone. This show is coming out July 7th, 2020. Now, of course, we don't yet know what the immediate or even the long-term effects of the COVID-19 pandemic in the United States and worldwide will be, but lately, protests against having to wear masks and living with other restrictions are getting a lot of attention in the media. Many anti-maskers are posting, frankly, bizarre claims on social media about health restrictions being un-American and comparing mask requirements to communism and yelling that health officials are Marxists. Now, social media being social media, however, there are lots of posts claiming lots of different things. As far as we at the Buzzkill Institute can tell, most of these are relatively normal and do not use faulty historical references to Marxism or totalitarianism or what, you know, or I should say whether health restrictions are un-American or not. But one of the most common threads I see on social media contain a lot of misunderstandings about the chronology of the 1918 influenza pandemic and whether government and societal action or inaction was responsible for that flu returning for a second and third wave, lasting roughly until April 1920. And I wanted to make comparisons, at least the reasonable comparisons, about what happened then and what might be happening now. So today, I'd like to talk about the second wave, specifically the second wave of the 1918 pandemic. But first, let me establish a couple of ground rules for comparison. Right off the bat, although commentators and medical experts have warned about a second wave of COVID-19 hitting the world in the fall of 2020, it's not at all clear when that's going to happen, at least not in terms of starting in a specific month or the infection curve starting to go up again once it hits a certain number at the bottom of that curve, if you know what I mean. You know, we have to hit bottom before it go, the death rate raises again, and that bottom is going to be X. It does seem, however, that, again, in the United States at least, we're not seeing yet the start of a second wave of the pandemic. The rise in cases and deaths recently seem to be still part of the first wave, which is a little troubling. And so what I'm trying to say is we can't place a chronological template from 1918 and the 1918 pandemic over a calendar of the year 2020 and chart when things will happen. And the second ground rule to keep in mind is that, naturally, the world was very different 100 years ago. Medical science was different, and the treatments of widespread illnesses were different. Most importantly, though, the major difference between then and now was the fact that World War I was still raging when the influenza broke out in 1918, and that governments, including the United States government, often privileged wartime concerns over public health concerns. Now, that might or might not seem unwise to us now, but in 1918, the First World War seemed to be of much greater concern in terms of human mortality than the influenza outbreak. Now, it turns out the influenza outbreak ends up killing a lot more people than the war. But many medical scientists at that time did not assume that that flu would last so long or be so deadly. So maybe it's understandable that governments heeded military concerns more than medical concerns. Now, before I go down the road of explaining the 1918 influenza pandemic second wave in too much detail, let me briefly tell you who the experts are that I've relied on for this show. Naturally, John Barry's book, The Great Influenza, is considered the best medical history of the pandemic and, of course, is on the Buzzkill bookshelf for this episode. Important also has been the work of Dr. James Harris at Ohio State University, and perhaps most importantly, the work of Dr. J. Alexander Navarro at the University of Michigan Center for the History of Medicine. Please note, though, this Dr. Navarro is not to be confused with Dr. Anthony Navarro, the economic and trade advisor to the Trump administration, who's one of President Trump's most trusted advisors on the response to the COVID-19 virus. Peter Navarro's advice to the president and his public comments on the pandemic and how to handle it have been, well, to put it mildly, controversial. The scholarly work of Dr. J. Alexander Navarro is, on the other hand, highly regarded and based on years of serious historical and archival work. So please don't confuse the two Navarros when you look at the blog post for this episode. Okay, now, what happened? As all of you know, the 1918 influenza pandemic broke out in March of that year. Historians of medicine aren't completely certain, but the consensus opinion seems to be that it started at a U.S. Army camp in Kansas. The virus went through the camp quickly, and since troops were being trained in one area and then moved rapidly around the country, the virus spread quickly to the east coast of the United States and then eventually to the Western Front in France when American troops joined the other Allied troops. Once there, it moved through almost all of Europe, including through the forces of Germany and Austria-Hungary. Now, most countries kept the news of the virus under wraps so as not to hurt national morale during the war. But Spain was neutral during the war, and their newspapers reported the outbreaks in that country. Those reports went to the foreign press, that is the non-Spanish press, and the influenza was reported, therefore, as, quote, the Spanish flu, which is why it's still lumbered with that incorrect attribution of its origin. Reports of influenza death seemed to lessen near the end of the summer of 1918, and it looked as if that epidemic might not turn into a devastating worldwide pandemic, but by August, a new strain of the virus appeared. And the more or less constant movement of troops to and from Europe and other places involved in the war spread that new strain. Crowded conditions and military transportation also meant that, you know, naval troop transports and troop trains were almost the perfect incubators and transmitters of each strain of the virus. It could have hardly been a more efficient way to spread the disease. So this was the 1918 influenza pandemic's second wave, and it proved far more deadly than the first. September and October were particularly bad months for mortality, especially in the United States. Nearly 200,000 Americans died in October alone. This new strain killed millions, and the manner of the deaths was particularly gruesome because the virus caused the body's natural immune system to kick into overdrive and end up killing the person while trying to kill the virus. Now, the massive death of the second wave very quickly surpassed the death toll of the initial outbreak. Historians of medicine and specialists in the 1918 pandemic are fairly certain that several non-medical factors or non-epidemiological factors were responsible for the increased deadliness of the second wave. Essentially, a combination of governmental preoccupation with military needs, a press muzzled by government censorship, and healthcare systems overwhelmed by the severity of the pandemic created the perfect conditions for massive death. Medical science couldn't develop a vaccine for the virus. Even things like the microscopes of the time weren't sophisticated enough to detect the details of this new virus and its evolving strains. By the late summer of 1918, also, severe nursing shortages ravaged the countries at war because the supply of nurses kept being split between, if you will, ordinary war service and the need for nurses to care for the exploding number of domestic influenza cases in each country. Press restrictions imposed by wartime governments made it very difficult for affected societies to mount what I call nationwide responses to the pandemic in each country. All too often, it seemed that the outbreaks of influenza were local or regional problems. It's not that the public literally didn't know about outbreaks in other cities and towns, but essentially, they didn't know enough. If they had, they might have put considerable pressure on their governments to react more comprehensively and in a more coordinated manner. And that brings me to what is probably the main reason why the 1918 second wave was so bad. The ways in which government preoccupation with pressing military concerns affected how they attempted to fight the pandemic within their own countries. And maybe this will provide us with glimpses of what we need to do to try to lessen the severity of the almost inevitable second wave of the COVID-19 virus. In other words, and as we'll see later on in the show, the second wave of the 1918 flu might have been less severe if what we now call social distancing and quarantining had been much more strictly and extensively followed. Let's just take two countries, Britain and the United States, as examples. The British government had figured out by late summer 1918 that the only effective way to fight the mortality rate of the virus was a severe quarantine of their domestic population. They had seen what limited local quarantining in schools and other aspects of civilian life had done to lessen the pandemic's impact. This led them to conclude that quarantining people would be the most effective way of stopping the spread of the virus. So it's not as if the British government or any other of the governments involved hadn't seen and understood the positive effects of the shutdown. No, the problem was that a shutdown, or the shutdown, meant the halt of troop movements throughout the country and to the battlefields. World War I soldiers were often rotated to the distant rear of battle areas in order to give them time to rest and recover from the stresses of modern warfare. Some British soldiers were routinely sent back to Britain itself at set intervals to rest and then return to the front. And of course, there was a constant demand for fresh troops, so new recruits had to travel to embarkation points in Britain and go to France and other areas of the conflict. The flow was constant. A shutdown also meant that civilian workers in munitions and war production would have had to stay home. Even though crowded factories were excellent environments, just like the crowded troop transports, to keep the influenza spreading, war production was considered so important that the government couldn't risk halting it or even slowing it down. The British government and the cabinet ultimately decided that both major aspects of the war, that is, troop movements and the production of war materiel, was more important than trying to halt the pandemic. A similar sort of thing happened in the United States, but the reaction came from state and city governments, not so much from Washington, D.C. So there was a great variation across the country, which again we're also seeing today. Where state and local governments imposed school closings, where they prevented large social gatherings, where they closed non-essential businesses and forced people to wear masks, the rates of infection and death were kept relatively low. Localities that did not do this sort of thing often saw devastating tragedies. The most famous of these was in the city of Philadelphia in late September 1918. The city had planned a major parade to encourage people to contribute to the Liberty Loan campaign to fund wartime needs. Cities and towns across the country were urged to raise money and raise as much money as they could, and some of them even built civic pride by competing with other cities and with other towns to see who could raise more money. Now, health officials in Philadelphia urged politicians in Philadelphia to cancel the parade because of the overcrowding it would cause, which would lead to increased and more efficient transmission of the virus. The politicians, however, again, they weighed this, they thought about it, they talked about it. They were afraid of the city appearing unpatriotic and not raising enough money for the war effort if they canceled the parade. So it went ahead. Now, perhaps even more deadly than the city's insistence on the parade happening was the sentiment of a great many Philadelphians, especially immigrants and German Americans, who believe they would be tarred as traitors if they didn't attend the parade and show their American patriotism. And as you undoubtedly know from other 1918 shows we've done, from reading in the popular press, et cetera, Philadelphia became the hardest hit city in terms of influenza mortality. 1,000 people died in just the 10 days following the Liberty Loan Parade in Philadelphia in late September. 1,000 people in the first 10 days after the parade. Now, in San Francisco, resistance to mandatory mask orders and social distancing erupted in early 1918, much like we've seen here in these last few months. The Anti-Mask League of San Francisco was formed in January of 1918 in direct response to a new city ordinance requiring people to wear masks in public. Nearly 5,000 people attended the first meeting of the Anti-Mask League on January 25th, and the group fought against these new city laws throughout most of the rest of 1918. Now, despite the fact that health officials had shown not only the city fathers, if you will, city governors, city politicians, but also the public, that masks and social distancing worked, the Anti-Mask League argued that masks were not necessary, that they trapped the virus and reinfected the wearers, which was just medically not true, and that forcing people to wear masks and to social distance violated their civil liberties. Sound familiar? San Francisco was still able to keep its infection rate relatively low because of those mask regulations, however. At least, that is, until November 11th, 1918. Yes, Armistice Day, when the fighting of World War II stopped. Some cities and towns in the United States ended their influenza restrictions in response to the end of the war and allowed large gatherings to celebrate the armistice. City centers filled with revelers, restaurants and bars opened to crowds of customers, movie houses opened, and live theater and vaudeville or plays started to get up again. Everything from the local cinema holding an audience of hundreds to the local coffee shop with a handful-sized crowd became popular again in November 1918, mid-November anyway, 1918. And you know what I'm going to say, buzzkillers? The influenza death toll spiked in places where this sort of reopening happened. Now, it's very difficult to apply a single cause to the appearance of the second wave of the 1918 influenza. In fact, it's impossible to find a single cause and a single group or system of thought to blame. Throughout this episode, you've noticed several reasons for the horrific second wave: governmental preoccupation with military needs, a press muzzled by government censorship, healthcare systems overwhelmed by the severity of the pandemic, and the celebrations after the November 11th armistice. But apart from not having a world war to fight, you've no doubt noticed a great many parallels between 1918 and how the COVID-19 pandemic has been handled this year, at least in the United States. And one might argue that the rhetoric and the pressures to reopen the American economy sound an awful lot like the rhetoric of the 1918 emphasis on the war as the nation's preoccupation. I don't want to rush to blame, and I don't want to rely too much on that old saw about not learning the lessons of the past, but it seems to me that there are two ways in which we're repeating the mistakes of 1918 during the increase in death rates from this last month, which is, after all, still within the first wave of this pandemic. First, the dramatic differences between the way states and localities are toying with their ideas of reopening their economies. And second, the shocking level of willful ignorance about and childish obstinance against simple and common sense health rules and practices among, admittedly, a minority of Americans. We are seeing history being repeated. I hope all decent and sane people will realize that we may very well be setting ourselves up for a 2020 influenza pandemic second wave that will be deadlier than the first. I would have hoped that some of the similarities to mid to late 1918 would be more obvious and better understood by our culture. Many people, some of the more sensible state governors, the actual scientists on various government health panels, are responsible and seem to be at least arguing for our national government and our populace to listen to reason, to listen to science, and to follow best medical practice. I just worry that those warnings are not being heeded as closely as they should be. And because of some of the things that happened in 1918, we've been told this lesson before. We should be listening. Talk to you next week.